The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And get a load of this. His mother's a Democrat and is 75 years old. Her son is a Republican supporting Ted Cruz, and they're both African-Americans from South Carolina. I'm betting that we have the best analysis of the GOP debate last night and the importance for both parties of South Carolina in the 2016 election that you're going to hear anywhere today. Stay tuned for that. But first, we go to Chicago, where a deeper pattern of police brutality is emerging as yet another video of a police shooting surfaces. An order by a federal judge this week allowed for the release of that police shooting of a white officer, black teenager shot while he was running away on foot. 17-year-old Cedric Chapman was thought to have been involved in a carjacking in January of 2013. Police pursued him, ultimately killed him. Police had accused Chapman of turning and pointing an object at police as he ran, but it turned out Chapman was unarmed. What was he pointing at police? A black iPhone. Richard Boykin is Cook County Commissioner in Chicago. He joins me from WBEZ. Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think this 2013 video says about a pattern of brutality that is way beyond a single incident here?
Look, I think it says that there is a culture of cover-up. There is a culture of protecting wrongdoers within the police department. This incident with Cedric Chapman is something that is unconscionable. Obviously, that on the heels of the release of the video with Laquan McDonald being shown walking away with a knife in his hand, not a threat to the officers on the scene. Let me be clear that there are good police within the police department. However, these incidences of police misconduct, they continue to be seen throughout the city of Chicago. Now, look, one of the things that's troubling for many of us is that there was an indictment in the Laquan McDonald case of Officer Van Dyke just hours before the release of the video. The prosecutor waited 400 days to make an indictment. We do not believe that she would have indicted that police officer if, in fact, the video would not have been ordered released by the judge. The other thing that's troubling in that case is that there were officers on the scene, about 7 or 8 officers. These officers filed false police reports to corroborate the account of Van Dyke, Officer Van Dyke. These officers have not been charged, have not been disciplined, and are still being paid and working.
It's legal to file a false police report in the city of Chicago or anywhere?
Look, it appears that that is the norm because the prosecutor has not indicted these officers for filing false police reports, nor have these officers been disciplined. I asked the question a few days ago in a committee hearing of the chief of staff to the state's attorney, Anita Alvarez. Have these officers been indicted or have these officers been disciplined? His response was the investigation is ongoing. None of us can understand. This has been 14 months. We all saw the video. I could deduce in 13 seconds that this was a murder in the Laquan McDonald case. This officer shot him in the back and shot him 16 times. This is wrong. We wouldn't treat an animal this way. And so why would we allow for officers to treat a human being this way?
Let's focus on the Chapman video for just a moment. It seems to me that, it's a distant shot of the victim. And I don't know. It's really very difficult to understand what's going on there. It's almost as though the cops just didn't have the energy to go after him. He was thought to be involved in a carjacking and just decided to bring him down just because that was easier. That's cold to say, but you just can't interpret it any other way.
Look, from the video, that's what it appears to be, and that should never happen. Look, the culture is set by the superintendent of police. Obviously, this superintendent, Gary McCarthy, is gone now. But the mayor ultimately selects the police chief or the police superintendent. We must send a signal through the Chicago Police Department that this type of behavior will not be tolerated. Now, the mayor, to his credit, has made some positive steps of reform. And these positive steps came as a result of the shooting of Quintonio LeGrier and Betty Jones, an innocent person who was just there on the scene. This shooting happened on the 26th of December. Of course, it was a shooting where the individual, Quintonio LeGrier, was having a mental health episode. He had a baseball bat in his hand. The officer, you know, shot him seven times and mistakenly shot or accidentally shot Betty Jones in the process. The mayor has ordered crisis intervention training for all police, and he's ordered tasers to be available in police units, in all police units. And so I think that those are necessary things that will help, hopefully, to save lives. But the other thing that the mayor should say is that individuals should not be shot in the back. If someone's fleeing a scene, look, from a carjacking, does the guy deserve to die? I don't think so. Let him flee the scene, catch up with him another day.
Finally, you mentioned a message needs to be sent. You talked about some reform measures that the mayor seems to be endorsing. But what firing or disciplinary action would be necessary to deliver that message, even to prosecutors and the court system, that this is just not going to be tolerated by the people of Chicago?
Look, so one of the things that we did in the Cook County Board, and I'm so proud of my colleagues, is that we passed a resolution calling for the appointment of a special prosecutor in the Laquan McDonald case, as there is a crisis of confidence right now as to whether or not the state's attorney can actually appropriately prosecute this case. Now, we believe, like in New York, where Governor Cuomo has actually issued an executive order, in all police-involved shootings of unarmed civilians, the appointment of a special prosecutor is automatically triggered. So we passed the first step of that. We're also trying to pass the second step of it. Right now, Governor Rauner in Illinois does not have the same kind of authority to issue an executive order to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to ask the legislature to give him that authority so that there is no question that justice and fairness will be done in police-involved shootings, and that this cozy relationship between prosecutors and police won't impede the justice system from flowing and the fact that individuals can get justice.
Richard Boykin is a Cook County Commissioner in Chicago. He spoke to us from WBEZ in that city. Commissioner, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
The World Health Organization had a mission accomplished moment this week, hours after officials at the WHO declared a final end to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. A new death from Ebola was reported in Sierra Leone. More than 11,300 people were killed last year in the outbreak. Officials are hoping that experience helps them in containing this incident. Miles O'Brien, science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. This isn't just a little mistake, is it?
Unfortunately, that appears to be the case, John. I've talked to some people on the ground there. And in this particular case, the woman who was infected with the Ebola virus traveled through several districts of Sierra Leone, at least three, went to a hospital, was treated, was not diagnosed at the time, was then discharged, sent home, after which she passed away. And her family was allowed to wash her in the ritual manner, which was at the very root of the spread of the Ebola virus more than a year ago. So it appears to be a case now where public health workers on the ground there will have a lot of people to be monitoring. It really reopens Ebola in Sierra Leone in a scary way.
Are they bracing for a number that they're putting on a whiteboard of how many further infections there might be if they get particularly unlucky here?
Well, you know, it's this kind of exponential thing, and so you really have to watch it. In this case, the good news is they know the index case, where it all begins, very quickly after the death, and they can begin the process of figuring out how much contact she had with other individuals, and they will continue to track them. But it opens up this, you know, period of time, at least 42 days, which, you know, this is a 21-day incubation period for Ebola, so at least 42 days to declare that the people she had contact with are in fact not infected by Ebola. But the insidious thing about Ebola, and the thing that has been bothering public health workers, is they have discovered Ebola in the semen of men who have survived the virus. And they just don't know how long the Ebola virus can lurk in that context. And so that opens up all kinds of possibilities for this kind of latent time bomb of Ebola spread.
Are doctors saying it's conceivable that Ebola could be a sexually transmitted disease?
It is conceivable. It hasn't been proven, but that is the concern, that it can stay in the semen. And what is not known is if it somehow can be spread as well by the woman. And if that is the case, that opens up a whole new dimension to Ebola. You know, the good news for all this is that the vaccine trials are going well. And if the world can get behind the idea of mass vaccinations there when the time is right, that will go a long way to stopping these Ebola outbreaks from turning into what we saw last year.
Trolling for some other good news here, is it possible that because of the so recent experience in all of these West African nations, that even a small incident that has a potential of being much larger, when you sound the alarm, people really listen and cooperate, unlike what was the case in the early going when the Ebola virus outbreak began last year?
Absolutely. I mean, that spread went a long way before the world really mobilized. You know, what you have is a dysfunctional healthcare network in that part of the world. These are the poorest countries in the world. And so Ebola spread quickly, and the world did not mobilize fast enough. And I think we can say, even today, even after the horrible irony of having this crop up the day after they declare it free, there still is a hair trigger alert in the region, and I hope that doesn't go away.
Miles O'Brien is a science correspondent for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much, Miles.
You're welcome, John.
It was Cruz and Trump being Godzilla and Little Godzilla last night at the GOP debate in South Carolina, fighting over whether New Yorkers are rude.
Everyone understands that the values in New York City are socially liberal or pro-abortion or pro-gay marriage, focus around money and the media.
We rebuilt downtown Manhattan, and everybody in the world watched, and everybody in the world loved New York and loved New Yorkers. And I have to tell you, that was a very insulting statement.
Marco Rubio preferred to direct comments at Hillary Clinton. Might not have helped him, though.
Someone who cannot handle intelligence information appropriately cannot be commander-in-chief. And someone who lies to the families of those four victims in Benghazi can never be president of the United States.
John Kasich, like the rest of the candidates, just tried to be noticed.
In this country, people are concerned about their economic future. That's not the America that I've ever known. My father used to say, Johnny, we don't hate the rich. We just want to be the rich.
And in the instant punditry of Twitter, here are four fab tweets. 89-year-old former member of Congress John Dingell said of John Kasich, Kasich tells more back-in-my-day rocking chair stories than me or anyone I know, and I was born during the Coolidge administration. And Hillary Clinton's Twitter reaction? 2.5 hours of this? Imagine 4 years. So with that small taste of the GOP debate and some real-time Twitter reaction, how was it in the audience for this raucous affair? Nze Ekpo is second vice chair of the South Carolina Republican Party. He joins us from Charleston. Welcome.
Glad to be here. Thank you very much.
You know, it seemed to me that the South Carolinians are really enjoying all this, looking for a fatal blow nastiness that was going on up there on stage.
Well, I think the gloves definitely came off more from Cruz. The gloves have always been off for Mr. Trump. But I think we saw a glimpse of Senator Cruz taking the gloves off. And I think he landed some body blows. I think he definitely had some return blows from Trump. But Trump has been an equal opportunity destroyer. So we knew those were coming. But I was impressed with Senator Cruz that he was able to make some lasting hits on someone who, to this point, has pretty much been impervious to attacks.
Can we talk body language for a bit? I thought it was really smart of Ted Cruz to match Trump's kind of smug frowns with that smile.
Yeah, Senator Cruz is extremely disciplined when it comes to all things political, I think. I think he's really impressive. And I agree with you. He's practiced the body language, and he killed them with kindness, as it were, with a smile. Because I think he wants to run a happy warrior-type campaign in the style of Ronald Reagan. But, yeah, his body language was very measured, and I think he had a little bit of fun with the Donald.
Happy warrior, though? I mean, he's described as nasty. David Brooks did this whole big takedown of Senator Cruz, saying that his approach to Syria, et cetera, is anything but Christian, and his notions of evangelical Christianity are at odds with the kind of mercy tone of most evangelicals. What do you think?
I think a lot of that is media hype, personally. In full disclosure, I do support Senator Cruz, but I think that's his opinion. I think some of the opinions were a little bit mean-spirited in comparing him to calling him pagan and these satanic and all of these different things. That, you know, it's kind of comical to think that, but everyone's entitled to their opinion. That's what makes our country great.
Did you see that Times piece weeks ago about how, you know, nobody has a good thing to say about him in the Republican Party, that, you know, even his college roommate thinks of him as an awful, awful person?
Yeah, I did read that. And I actually think that that might actually help him, because the mood in the country now is one of dissatisfaction with both parties, Republicans and Democrats. So when someone is touted as being hated by both the left and the right, that's not necessarily a bad thing, in my opinion.
Interesting. That is quite interesting. Rubio could not break out last night. I thought that was another big takeaway. And it does seem as though the days of Jeb Bush are numbered, and the other candidates just don't seem to be able to get any kind of traction in this environment. It really isn't about Trump. It's about this environment.
Right. I thought Rubio was the big loser last night, in my opinion.
And that's because of the way he interacted with Cruz, that people are finally seeing him as unimpressive. What do you think?
I don't think it's just that. I think that Rubio seemed bent on destroying President Obama, and every comment that he made. I think if you look at the tape, it's just, you know, he's constantly bashing the president. And of course, there's a degree of that all candidates will do, but it's my wife and I noticed he prefaced almost everything with how, you know, bad the president was doing and everyone else. I mean, he made the line that Hillary Clinton is not qualified to be president. Now, I'm a conservative Republican guy, and even I think that rhetoric is a little bit over the top. Nobody was really saying that. I mean, we all agree as Republicans that we think one of our people would be better. But to say that she's unqualified, some of the hits that he made against the Cruz tax plan were questionable. And just, I think his tone, he came off as more aggressive. I think he was purposely trying to come off as aggressive, but I think it just didn't really sit well, in my opinion.
That raises an interesting issue for South Carolina. A lot of focus on Iowa and New Hampshire, of course, in the early going here. But South Carolina is really, in some ways, maybe an even more important bellwether. And I'm just wondering if the GOP candidates here, Rubio being the example that you mentioned, are really not thinking deeply about criticizing the president so much, because especially in South Carolina, you've got a lot of African-American voters in South Carolina who don't necessarily hear the message that's being delivered from the candidate. All they're hearing is a kind of an intolerance and a nastiness that goes directly to a kind of racial polarization piece.
Right. And, you know, I'm an African-American, and that's why I thought that Rubio's attacks were, he might have meant well. I think they just didn't come across well. As we progress in these debates, I think the candidates need to address policy more directly rather than just, you know, hit piece type sound bites. But that's to be expected in these debates. But, yeah, I would agree with you.
hold the pundit hat. Do you think by next January your governor will still be working in the state house in South Carolina?
Nikki Haley is very talented, so it just depends. I think she would be a great asset to any administration. There's a lot of talk about her being a vice presidential pick or a cabinet level. She's very talented, and she bespeaks the diversity that our party really has. So when you look at our slate of candidates, you have prominent African-Americans, you have senators in their 40s, you have elder statesmen, you have a wide variety, which you don't quite see this time around on the other side of the ticket, in my opinion.
And Sayakpo is second vice chair of the South Carolina Republican Party. He spoke to us from Charleston, South Carolina.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
Sir, yes, sir!
Private Joker, why did you join my beloved Corps?
Sir, to kill, sir!
I apologize, it's not my fault. The waves are getting blown out by the napalm.
Let me see your war face.
Rafer Guzman has a war face. He's in the studio here Friday to do movies, and it feels like news. Movies are news. 13 Hours, The Secret Soldiers of Benghazi. This is Michael Bay's movie about the Benghazi incident. Let's hear a clip.
You have a U.S. ambassador at risk.
The ambassador is in his safe haven. You're not the first responders. You're the last resort. You will wait.
None of you have to go. We are the only help they have.
This feels like Lone Survivor and Black Hawk Down with a rock and roll soundtrack.
It meets the Transformers, of course. I mean, it's a Michael Bay. It's a Michael Bay film. I think what everyone wants to know is whether this is going to be kind of the January surprise for Hillary Clinton and rake her over the coals. Is this going to be kind of a partisan political take on the movie? It's not explicitly partisan. This is really just supposed to be the story of the six military contractors. John Krasinski plays one of them. He's our main guy through this film, who defended that diplomatic outpost and the CIA base that the Libyans came after as well. It's not, as I say, it's not an explicitly political film, I don't think. Clinton is never named. But, you know, Michael Bay, very pro-military, has always been, you know, very enamored of weaponry and, you know, those boots on the ground. And you get a lot of that here. I will say the one politician I think who will like this film is Donald Trump. It's really got a Donald Trump worldview to it. All politicians are idiots. The Middle Easterners are untrustworthy. Women should shut up. And, you know, diplomacy is for fools. I think Ambassador Christopher Stevens comes off looking like a very naive, tragic figure, you know, who really thought that he could talk to these people and, you know, look what happens to him. So I think there's something kind of, there's something a little red meat about this film that I didn't like, the way it sort of vilifies everybody else but the soldiers.
Sounds like an interesting psychological artifact about some sort of state of the U.S. psyche.
I mean, there is a lot of this. The whole idea behind this film, if you've seen the trailer, you know this scene with one of the guys saying, "How willing are you to die for your country?" And that's the gist of this film. We've got the stiffer spine. We're the ones who are really willing to step up at these Libyans. You know, they don't actually have the commitment. Only we do. So there is something a little red state, I think, about this movie, but it is not a partisan takedown of Clinton.
Movie number two, Norm of the North, has a kind of a newsy angle on the opening of the Arctic and global warming.
Yeah, this is Rob Schneider plays the voice of Norm the polar bear. I'll see if I can get this straight. He's a polar bear who realizes that condos are coming to the Arctic. He wants to stop this, so he's going to go to New York to start a television campaign because he speaks English. Although the television campaign is predicated on the fact that he's actually just an actor in a bear costume. He has to fool people into thinking he's not a real bear. Little puzzling. Here's an example.
What's your plan here?
Well, Mr. Green wants to use me to sell the Arctic, and I'm going to use the Arctic to save it.
Exactly. You have to rally the public so that they love you, wait for your moment, and turn them against Green. Use his own plan to defeat him. But the key is to make sure you time your moment just right when the public loves you the most.
Not the bear from The Revenant here.
No, much kinder, gentler bear. I will just say this, John. I think if you and I sat down for 90 seconds, you and I could also write a film this bad. It would be that easy. Poor
Thanks.
Rob Schneider has not been in a good film in so long.
For the insult. That was a terrible insult.
I didn't mean it that way, John.
Movie number three, Ride Along 2. This is a big comedy with a lot of expectation.
Right. Kevin Hart, Ice Cube, they're back. Kevin Hart is the rookie cop this time. He used to be a wannabe. Now he's a probationary officer. Ice Cube is the surly Atlanta cop. They're going to go to Miami and solve a drug case.
With a great line from the trailer, if you say that again, I'm going to shoot you in the face.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Possibly the funniest line in the film, actually.
Ooh.
It's not great. The first one was not great, and I think this one is even weaker.
It'll still do well, though.
I think it may do well. I'm not sure we're going to see a Ride Along 3, though.
Well, have a great weekend. Watch the movies. And, you know, you can give us your reviews at 877-8-MY-TAKE if you want. We haven't done that for a while. Rafer Guzman is a film critic for Newsday. Hey, Rafer, you have a good weekend as well.
Thanks. You too, John.
Nigerian independence.
1960 is a very great year for Africa and for Nigeria.
Today marks the 50th anniversary of Nigeria's first coup d'etat. The country had only been out from under British rule for 6 years when Nigerian soldiers assassinated nearly a dozen Nigerian politicians. The acting president announced the transfer of power to the military, and shortly thereafter, General Oguya Iranse held his first press conference.
My main concern is to restore law and order as soon as possible.
That law and order wouldn't come for another 30 years, and today Nigeria is a burgeoning democracy with one of Africa's largest economies. Its promises of prosperity are just now coming true, and Nigerians are beginning to be able to laugh at themselves. Here's famous comedian Clint the Drunk making fun of the many uniformed officials who can demand a bribe or, worse, toss you in the slammer on a whim.
I'm sorry, sir. Please, I respect men in uniform. Even children in school uniform, I respect them. After my last experience, believe me, experience is not the best teacher. Experience is the one that leads you straight to hospital.
Max Siolan is a Nigerian historian and author who says the people have heard claims of better times ahead for most of their lives.
The coup was supposed to be a revolution to get rid of all the ills in the country's politics and society, like corruption and ethnic rivalry. Instead, it turned into somewhat of a case of good intentions and dreadful consequences. And Nigeria basically descended into a succession of military dictatorships. And the military, which was supposed to be temporary redeemers, ended up ruling the country under increasingly authoritarian regimes for 29 of the next 33 years.
Part of what was driving what happened in Nigeria was an effort and a need and a real yearning to get past the colonial period. Was Nigeria successful in that?
Nigeria obviously was a former British colony, and it was really looked upon as the great hope, quote unquote, the giant of Africa that was supposed to be the first African superpower. But less than 6 years after gaining independence, after the British left, the country just descended into ethnic war, civil war, chaos, military dictatorship. So very, very soon after colonialism ended, the hopes for a better future were dashed very quickly.
Nigeria has a huge amount of natural resources, and its ability to survive off of those natural resources has certainly framed the way Nigeria has developed. But why didn't Nigeria go the way of Congo and Zaire, in that it became a kind of kleptocracy where a single dictator ruled for a very, very long period of time? That really wasn't the case in Nigeria.
Yeah, and the economic resources you mentioned were actually a catalyst and incentive for the succession of military dictatorships. Nigeria is by far the richest country in Africa. And unfortunately, all the various ethno-regional interest groups in the country were basically fighting each other to get access to that oil wealth. So it was really a case of that wealth becoming a curse on the country and becoming an incentive for the military dictatorships to seize power and for them being reluctant to relinquish control of the vast wealth in the country as well.
What led to the Biafran War, which really created the divisions in Nigeria that we still see echoes of today?
The north of the country is predominantly Islamic, and the south is predominantly Christian. And not only were the two regions ethnically and religiously polarized, but they were economically and educationally so as well, because the south was far more educated, far more advanced than the north in the 1960s. What happened in 1966 is that a group of army officers from the better educated south staged a coup and assassinated the leaders of the government at the time, who all happened to be northerners from the Muslim north. And that stoked fears in the north that the better educated south were going to take over the country and dominate the north and relegate them to second class status forever.
And how did that become a shooting war that really in some ways persists today? Boko Haram's demands on the south are really reminiscent of exactly what was being talked about decades ago.
Well, both regions, the north and south, have fears of each other based on different factors. Now, the issue you mentioned with Boko Haram, that actually is a byproduct of military rule. Because the military spent so much time in power, the country became thoroughly corrupted. The society became very, very militarized, and the use of force basically became an accepted and reasonable avenue for resolving conflict in the society. So I think you need to contextualize and look at the Boko Haram insurgency really as a rebellion against both corruption in Nigerian society and in some ways as a rebellion against traditional northern authority.
You write about the period of instability that began in 1966, and you end your story in 1976. How would you describe that 10-year period and what it transformed?
I think that conflict taught the combatants a very, very bitter lesson about the evils of ethnic rivalry. And out of the ashes of that war and conflict came this sober realization that Nigerians have got to figure out a reasonable way to live together. And as a result of that, a few years later, Nigeria developed a very, very elaborate constitution with really, really creative mechanisms for power sharing, for making sure that one part of the country does not economically or politically dominate the other. Power rotates between the north and the south on a sequential basis. And I think the lessons learned in that decade of conflict are pretty much what is holding Nigeria together today, albeit every now and then that unity gets rocked.
The talk of Nigeria being the rich country of Africa and the heroic sort of leader of African development back in the 60s, we're hearing that talk today, that Nigeria is the development leader and that there's an exciting sense of maybe some of that is coming true now, even with all the problems in Nigeria. Does that give people hope?
Absolutely. I think Nigeria has learned lessons from its blood-soaked past. And I think also the demographics of the country are helping. Something like two-thirds of the population are under 30 years of age, and they don't carry the same emotional baggage, the same sense of ethnic rivalry that their parents and grandparents carried. So now in Nigeria, you have a younger, more urbane, very educated population that grew up in multi-ethnic, multi-religious environments and don't view ethnicity as a be-all end-all like the generation before them.
Max Yolen is Nigerian historian, writer, and author of the books Oil, Politics, and Violence, Nigeria's Military Coup Culture, 1966 through 1976, and Soldiers of Fortune, A History of Nigeria. Max, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The nation of Haiti has its own brutal narrative of instability, disaster, and a poverty that eludes any solution despite the billions contributed from around the world and spent by the many NGOs working in Haiti for decades. This week marks the sixth anniversary of the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, a 7-magnitude quake that killed more than 220,000 people. The emerging generation of Haitians will be defined by their survival of this disaster, just as author M.J. Fievre's generation is defined by the violence of the Tonton Macoute in the years of Haiti's president-priest Jean-Bertrand Aristide. M.J. Fievre's memoir is called A Sky the Color of Chaos. She says there are many voices in Haiti, trying to find new colors.
A lot of writers right now are trying to change the fact that Haiti is only seen when tragedy strikes. I think literature is a good way to show all the facets of Haiti. You know, it's not that what we get from the news is not true, but there's so much more to Haiti than the violence and the poverty. And I try to do just that in my book, A Sky to Call of Chaos. I try to present Haiti entirely.
You write about places of truly unspeakable beauty in this book, A Sky, the Color of Chaos. You also write about the violence, and I sometimes feel as though the title of the book is your way of, as a little girl, being able to look up and cause all of the instability and fear that was happening at ground level to go away. Did you used to do that?
I used to do that. And there is a scene in the book where I find myself at the wrong place, at the wrong time, and there's a protest going on and things go crazier than they already were that day, and people start shooting. And I find myself on the ground trying to remain safe, and I'm looking at the sky, and the sky is a perfect blue. It's such a beautiful blue, and yet I'm listening to all those people yelling and people are shooting around me. That beauty is what kept me grounded that day.
You walk into places of such ugliness in this book, and you walk into them with such casualness. Not that you're unafraid of them or that you don't understand what you're doing, but you have a childlike quality. I'm thinking of the scene where you go to the morgue. How did you reconcile the life that was all around you and the death that was all in that room?
You know, it was at that point I really had to grow up, because I knew there was the violence. I heard about it on the radio. I saw it on TV, and I witnessed a few very remarkable scenes. But I had never really seen the result the way I got to see in the morgue. It was just awful. Piles and piles of bodies with no one coming and claiming them. And most of them were the results of the either violence or the fact that there was an embargo in Haiti. So that moment was when I really felt for myself the consequences of everything that had been going on.
You also write about love and lost love in this book, and it's something very, very personal. And when this man was gone, and you can tell me the circumstances in a moment, you describe that you had late nights of perplexity and private sorrow when you gorged on your own heart, unable to silence your demons. He invaded my dreams, which scattered me across the globe. He hid in the corners of my mind and appeared when I was alone. Broody, soulful layers of sweat and oil thickened on his skin like glaze. That's a very powerful sense of yearning and loss. And yet you get so accustomed to loss, it seems, in Haiti, that I feel as though you were really prepared to have something like that taken from you.
Right. Loss in Haiti, it's not that we get used to it, but we get reacquainted with it quite
often. You prepare for it.
Right, so that you're always ready for the worst. I mean, even the decision to leave your house in the morning makes you wonder about whether you're going to come back, because there are random acts of violence, so that you're always ready for the worst. But when the worst happens, somehow it still takes you by surprise because you don't expect it to still hurt that much. So as a teenager, I didn't really have a healthy relationship with guys. So that this particular man that you read about, I made him my whole life because I needed someone to keep me above water. The fact that I was stuck in the country I wanted to leave so badly, I was in a situation at home where my dad terrorized us, that I wanted someone to just take care of me, and that's what he did, that young man. So that when he left, I did feel quite devastated, and I couldn't help compare that loss to all the many losses that we endure when we live in Haiti.
What do you want people to take from this story?
Well, when I moved to Miami about 13 years ago, one thing that I've noticed is that because I come from another place, I was seen as other, which is kind of surprising when you think about it, because everyone in Miami is from somewhere. Most people are from some other place. But yet, you know, people are trying to figure you out. Who are you? And they have this idea of life in Haiti that really doesn't resonate to be true to me. So when I started writing this book, one of my main concerns was to show people how it is to live in Haiti. Because in my mind, I just had a regular childhood. You know, I had a life. Living in Haiti is possible, and this is how it was done. So a young person, whether from Haiti or not, will definitely relate to the fact that so often as teens we feel alienated, there's a lot of solitude, falling in love for the first time, and being misunderstood by family members and by friends, experiencing certain kinds of friendship for the first time, and the impact of growing up in a certain place has on anyone. It might be Haiti for me, but a girl from Little Havana, for instance, might relate to how a place shapes who you are.
Well, MJ, it's lovely to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, John, for having me.
MJ Fievre is a poet and author, most recently of A Sky the Color of Chaos, out now. And here's something to take with you today. Last November in Brazil, the Fundão Dam, owned by mineral company Samarco, collapsed, causing the worst environmental disaster in the country's history, sending mud and toxic minerals tailing down the Rio Doce Basin, burying villages and killing 19 people. The government has accused 7 people and 3 companies of environmental crimes, just one of the tragedies unfolding in a country where the government is facing impeachment, the economy is collapsing, and babies are being born with a terrifying, mysterious virus causing their brains and heads to shrink. On Monday, The Takeaway will take a look at what it's going to be like for American companies doing business in troubled Brazil to endure close scrutiny of the world as the Olympics and the rest of the planet come to that South American nation. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.